They come from the bowels of hell.
The Dana Gould Hour.
Jungle worms and swamp rats run around your feet.
I bought a dog that killed a calf that ate the canary. What is truth?
And once again, welcome back.
We're back. My guest today is Jay Kogan. Now, you are probably mostly familiar with that name if you are a Simpsons fan, going back to the very beginning, because that is when Jay was on the show. He was there at the ground floor with his writing partner, Wally Walidarsky. They were among the original writers of the show. They created it and helped form the show as we know it today. Jay created Duff Beer, Kang and Kodos, and so much more. He was also a writer on Frasier, for which he won an Emmy. And Jay created, along with me, one of my very first pilots, the late lamented World on a String, which got made, did not go to series, but did inadvertently lead to me eventually joining the writing staff of The Simpsons myself. Jay is also a second-generation comedy writer. His dad, Arnie Kogan, was a writer for The Tonight Show, The Carol Burnett Show, Mad Magazine, and Jay grew up in that world. Tons of amazing stories. I will be posting World on a String for your viewing pleasure on my Patreon page in the next couple of days. On True Tales from Weirdsville, this episode will have the strange, ugly, and oh-so-prescient story of Confidential Magazine. Anyone who has ever read a James Ellroy novel will know Confidential Magazine as Hush, Hush, off the record, on the QT, and very Hush, Hush. But it was real, it was awful, and it was ahead of its time. As for me, if you are in Los Angeles, I will be performing with Eddie Pepitone and Hannah Einbinder, two of the finest comedians I know, at the Yard Theater on Melrose Avenue and Heliotrope, that's down by LA City College, and the space that used to be the fake gallery. The Yard Theater is run by Robbie Sullivan himself, John Ennis, and we will be performing there on Friday, February 28th. If you live in LA and you want to see a full hour-long set, I will be headlining in Burbank on March 14th at Flappers, a great club with a name I'd change, but it's not mine, so I won't. But I will be performing there on March 14th, a full show, so come on down. On March 25th, I will be in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the North Carolina Comedy Festival. And from April 23rd to 25th, Bobcat Goldthwait and I will be bringing The Show with Two Heads to the Moon Tower Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. For ticket information for any and or all of these, please go to danagould.com/events. Lastly, before we go, please allow me to say a word about our Patreon feature. We have one. It's simple, and I hope you sign up. $5 a month gets you the title Dana Gould Hour Sky Cadet. And for that month, every month, you get a bonus interview segment, you get some video content, etc., etc. This is a special show, and our Patreon reflects that. We don't have graded levels. For $25, I'm not going to come to your house and shampoo your dog. For $5, you're a Sky Cadet, you get some stuff, and off we go. So go to danagould.com for details, and danagould.com/events for information and ticket links for all of the gigs we've heard about here. And now, it's on to our filthy business.
Dana Gould Hour. Free and worth it.
Oh, God, it's a beautiful day high atop the Mulholland Drive view shelf here in sunny Southern California. We're at Falcon's Lair Recording Studios, surrounded by dogs and leaf blowers. I have an old dear friend of mine, and thank you. He's shaking off now. one of the people that when I moved to Los Angeles and started hanging out with people that were not just stand-up comedian friends from San Francisco that also lived in Los Angeles, I was like, wow, I'm kind of cool. I'm friends with this guy. One of the original Simpsons writers, Emmy Award winner for his work on Frasier. You are also an improv actor and an actor. You wrote one of my favorite comedy films of all time. Please welcome the lovely and talented funny woman, Jay Cogan.
This is the sound of my voice.
You were one of the, you were in the first crop of Simpsons writers.
I was in the very first crop of Simpsons writers. I was there the very, very beginning when it was just four people. It was Matt and Sam and me and Wally.
Wow, I didn't even know you went that far back.
And then,
that's what, 89?
88, 89, yeah, when we were just talking about making a TV show.
Was it at one point called Not the Cosby Show?
It was never called Not the Cosby Show. We didn't even expect to be against the Cosby. That was
right.
But no, it was what should have been called was We Expect This to Fail. That's what it should have been called. Fox is stupid enough to pick up a cartoon,
right?
So we're going to make one, and it's going to be a disaster.
But it was on the Tracy Ullman Show already.
Yeah, there was a cartoon that was a, you know, 30 second snippets, maybe 15 second snippets, right, on the Tracy Ullman Show. Very short.
Homer sounded like Walter Matthau.
Yeah, and looked different, and the animation was different, and was getting good reaction from our studio audience when we showed clips together.
No, I remember going to see Field of Dreams, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
With Kevin Costner, and they showed a Simpsons short before the movie.
Yes, a therapy.
Yeah, yes. And people went bananas.
Yes, and that...
And it was a reaction to The Cosby Show, because at the time, The Cosby Show was the number one comedy in America.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Cosby was and is the most respected man in the country.
Well, Dana, wait, you may not have heard.
But that is funny. I was at a yard sale, not to brag.
Sure, no.
And there was an Old People magazine readers poll. 1986.
Was it Old People magazine?
It was an Old People magazine.
I don't know where you are in your life, Dana.
Well, I get that magazine too.
Yeah, okay.
It's called the ARP.
Yeah, okay.
I get it every month. I throw it in the garbage.
Sure.
I'm not old. I throw it in the garbage. But it was a reader survey. Most respected man in America was Bill Cosby.
Sure.
We didn't know.
No, we didn't.
We didn't know.
And I respected him plenty because he was a damn funny comedian.
No, it's...
Yeah.
And you think, you know, also at the same time, Michael Jackson at the peak of his powers.
Yes.
We didn't know. He left a trail of breadcrumbs.
Yeah. No. So every, you know.
There was chum in the water that we didn't smell.
Yeah. I was, he was a weird cat. I knew him just a little bit. So I did.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He was a weird guy.
Well, we could discuss that, but this is neither the time nor the place.
Okay. Well,
no, I'm kidding. How did you know Michael Jackson?
I knew Michael Jackson because he lived down the street from me. In Encino.
Yes.
I grew up in Encino. He grew up in Encino. So I would occasionally run into him at a place called Mike's Pizza, which was near Gelson's on Havenhurst and Ventura. And, you know, he was just a local guy. And,
off the wall.
A star.
Yeah.
Nonetheless. So you'd go, oh, that's Michael Jackson.
But this is like 70s.
70s, yeah. But then my dad did a summer show with the Jacksons, a Jackson 5 summer show.
So we have to unpack this just for the audience.
Okay.
You grew up in the Valley. You're a LA native.
I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and my father, who's a TV comedy writer, was a comedy writer for comedians and for many things, Mad Magazine.
Anybody who owns old Mad Magazines
has Arnie Cogan.
Arnie Cogan.
Sure.
I believe he wrote The Poop Side Down Adventure.
Might as well. Yeah, sure. James Baum, I believe. many other.
And he wrote on Carol Burnett, didn't he?
He wrote the Carol Burnett show, but he moved out of New York to, he was writing on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, which was in New York, to come work on The Dean Martin Show in California. So we the family decided to move with dad.
Sure. Why not? That was good.
Yeah, it was a good choice. And so when I was five, I moved to California and we moved to Woodland Hills. Right. And I've been here ever since.
Wow. And how old were you then? 5 years old?
5 years old.
Now, did your father work for Johnny Carson at the same time Tom LaSalle's father was working for Johnny Carson?
Yeah, we knew the LaSalle's. Mm-hmm. And we knew...
And are you friends with Tom?
Friendly? He and I do not speak.
Oh, okay.
We hate each other with a white hot passion. No, it's fine. It's fine. No, we do not hate each other. We don't really hang out. We don't know
He's
each other
my manager. That's But we do not speak.
No. Okay, well, that's weird.
he's the nice guy.
Go
He wouldn't be my manager.
Sure. I could have a horrible man. I could have an evil person being my manager.
Well, but your father is...
showfolk.
And funny and like a funny guy to sit in a writer's room with.
Yeah, he's really funny still to this day, sharp and funny. And
you chose to go into his same line of work, which
it's not at all a desperate plea for my father to love me.
Not
it is
at all.
Absolutely separate from that in some other way that I don't know.
We should say your new book is called Triggered.
And my dad wrote on variety shows, but he also wrote on sitcoms and The Newhart Show and Mary Tyler Moore and MASH and all these other things. But one of the variety shows he did was...
He wrote on MASH?
Yeah, we read an episode of MASH.
Did he ever come home just like muttering, fucking Harvey Korman?
Never. My dad always had a really good attitude about
business. He doesn't seem like he wouldn't.
He was thrilled.
He's a lovely man. He just has a beautiful vibe.
He's a guy who's from Brooklyn who never thought he could be in show business. And any time he got the opportunity to write and do stuff and work with stars, he just couldn't believe it. And still to this day.
And that's the way to be.
He would be otherwise in the schmata business in some weird thing. And that was not the life he wanted. So, he's very happy. But no, he didn't hate Harvey Korman. And Harvey Korman gave me one of my first writing jobs. Harvey Korman did. He asked me to write a page of jokes he was writing. I was 10 years old. He thought it was funny. And he asked me to write a page of jokes for a Dodgers roast. He was roasting Tommy Lasorda, I think, something like that. And I wrote a page of jokes, and he paid me $100.
That's great.
10 years old.
I like Harvey Korman all the more now.
Is that great? It's fabulous. Great. It was unbelievable that he, A, had faith in me, and B, did that. And I didn't hear back that these jokes were shit, which everyone I've ever written for since has said at least some version of.
Exactly. No, it's a... we have to get back to Michael Jackson, but to continue this thread, last year I spent a lot of time with Mel Kaminsky, known to the world as Mel Brooks.
Sure.
And
by choice?
We did something together.
Okay, great.
We did something together.
Because he could just come over.
And he would come over.
Yeah.
No, it was a weird... You know, I knew this person who knew this person, and he was looking for somebody that was funny but knew about this, and we ended up working on something for you. And I'll talk about it more when I'm... but Mel would go like, oh, why is Harvey Korman gone? I need him for this. Like, he's... I've never seen a guy like Dick Van Patten is gone. Who can play this? Dick is gone. I can hear Dick saying it.
That must be hard to have all the people that you work with gone.
And every day somebody else goes.
Yeah.
That's the thing. When you're 94, the phone rings.
Yeah.
So-and-so died. It's a quote for the obits in the New York Times every day. We need a quote for this. We need a quote for that.
Yeah. Now, if he wasn't Mel Brooks and just a guy on a bench, this conversation would take a different tone.
Yeah.
I gotta go home. Nice talking to you. Good luck.
Yeah, well, that guy wasn't paying me.
Right.
The guy on the bench was paying me what Mel was paying
me. Exactly. You might stay. That's true. Stay. Yeah.
Yeah. But he would last thing. I don't mean to talk about myself in your interview. So he wanted Dr. Zayas to be, and he thought that was funny. And I said, well, what if they're in the cantina and there's a ventriloquist acting. Dr. Zayas is ventriloquist and he's got a dummy, but the dummy is like bearded and dirty and in a loincloth. And I'm like, how do you like school, Billy? And the dummy just stands there. Come, Billy, Billy. And then the dummy turns its head and it's got a big horseshoe. And he goes, no. No. Here's the Library of Comedy. Where does it say punchline
brain surgery scar.
You did a whole scene with people farting.
Right.
You're going to get bit.
Right.
And I said that to him once. I go, you did a whole scene where people just farted. He goes, right. It's the only thing anybody ever fucking talks about.
Which is also true.
Yeah, so, it's true.
Yeah.
So your father worked for the Jacksons. Summer series. You live near him in Encino, right.
and
you're a kid in L.A. in the late 70s.
But he came. But the Jacksons came over to our house.
Oh, okay.
On the premiere of that summer show.
Wow.
So it was Marlon, Jackie,
Tito,
Jermaine, and Joe Jackson, and the mom, and Michael, and Janet. And Randy and all the Jackson.
Yeah, wow.
Reba and LaToya were let into. We didn't want to, but we let them into. And me and my sister and my mom and my dad and some other people and my Nana Chicky. So my grandmother was like talking to Tito a lot, which was really weird. It's like a weird image in my head of my Nana talking to Tito.
But Tito liked the Grey Panthers. That's what I understand.
He did. And Michael was just incredibly quiet. And, I mean, they all were incredibly shy.
Well, they're Mormons. They're very,
Jehovah's Witnesses. And they're also, you know, I think beaten within an inch.
Yeah, Joe was Darth Vader.
They're scared. But, so it was very.
But you and Michael were kind of this close in age.
I was closer to Randy's age than Michael's. But, it wasn't like a relationship, but I knew him in passing.
Yeah, acquaintanceship.
And when he came to The Simpsons to do The Simpsons, I was around for that. And it was very weird to see how much he had changed.
But did he recognize you or did you
I said, hey, it's me, Jake Hogan from Encino. And he went, And like, he did not.
Nothing.
No, I mean, and he was wearing crazy orange pancake makeup on his face and really thick that you could see cakey makeup on his face. And he had a lot of requests at The Simpsons. When he came to The Simpsons, he wanted a room full of, at 20th Century Fox, we recorded on that soundstage.
Sure.
At the bottom of the soundstage, he asked for a room full of cases of Evian water and 20 room heaters. That's what he wanted.
Okay.
And he never went in there. I don't know why he wanted that.
And I don't know if he wants that or if an assistant.
I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is, with all that orange makeup, even he thought back then, I could be president.
Maybe. I know that he was.
That's a shame that he didn't. Like, it would be funny if he was like, it's me, Jake Hogan from Encino. And he's like, hey, man. And he's like, this fucking shit's bullshit.
Yeah, I know.
What's the dude in my nose?
Some glimmer of humanity. But he had, you know, Jim was convinced he was an artist, and he was an artist.
Oh, he
like he wanted that artistry, but his humanity was very hard to tap into. And I understand, you know, also from being just a guy on the outside, why would he open up to us? But I kept looking for it.
You know? Yeah, well, because you didn't know him when.
Right.
And so there's that element.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people, like, you know, did you see, Dolomite Is My Name?
Of course. Loved it.
So, gosh.
Yeah.
So
great.
So great. And, you know, Eddie Murphy used to have all of his friends from before he broke in his, quote, posse.
Sure.
And we used to make fun of it. Like, why does a comedian need a posse?
Right.
But he wasn't a comedian. He was Elvis.
Right.
And you need people that you know don't want anything from, even though they're on the payroll.
But that's the problem. You need people who don't want anything from you. And if they're on the payroll, they stop being that thing.
You're right. But I can understand the motivation of like, this is how I will keep you around me all the time.
Yeah.
Is that you won't go off to work. You'll be with me.
Right.
And same with Elvis. And there is a comfort in that like, oh, I can fart around you and it's fine.
And we have a shared history and they know each other and you know your secrets will be safe and all that other stuff. Yeah, I completely understand all that stuff. But I think that installation that you get and that, you know, it's a false sense of security.
Yeah.
When you're in that.
Well, you're buying familiarity.
Right.
You know, and that's why I think, and I don't know him at all, but, you know, he's like, he's just been raising kids. He had 10 kids.
Yeah.
And Your kids absolutely don't care that you're famous.
Right.
And
right.
That's got to be for a guy that, you know, for three decades was so, you know, couldn't do anything
right.
In the real world. That's got to be like, yeah, they don't give a shit who that
right.
I was, yeah.
Right.
I, yeah, that I'm Axel Foley. They don't care.
You grow. They grow in, you know, I think there's something about celebrity that it's nice. It's nice when the peak comes down a little bit and you can actually be
a human
again.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that's a nice thing. But yeah, to still collect a massive paycheck would also be nice. Yeah.
His daily residual haul has to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Maybe. I always think that whenever I guesstimate somebody's money intake, I'm wrong.
Yeah.
By exponential amounts.
Right. But just think of the SAG residuals alone.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. But yeah. Maybe I'm sure he's not hurting for money. I'm not concerned about that.
I bet he's like, not.
Whatever my guess is of how much he's worth or how much he's got.
He is selling a bike on eBay. I know that. I was going to say through the recycler.
Right.
Because it was bike.
Sure.
So I didn't know that you, I did not know that you knew Michael Jackson growing up in the Valley. Did you, I've had other people that grew up in the Valley, Rob Zabrecki, who you might know.
Just because I grew up in the Valley doesn't mean I know everybody from the Valley.
No, I know that, but he's also in showbiz.
I don't know Rob Zabrecki.
Rob Zabrecki was the lead singer of Possum Dixon, and now he's an actor and a magician. Works at the Magic Castle. Oh, wow. And Allison Martino, who runs the Vintage Los Angeles website. She's mm-hmm. Al Martino's daughter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And Tom DeSavia, who's an AR guy.
Okay.
And they all grew up in the Valley, all around our age. But especially Rob and Tom, they were big into the punk scene. They mm-hmm. were seeing a lot of shows.
Yeah.
The Mask, I think, is a little early for them. Mm-hmm. But did you get into that, or were you on the other side of that?
I was in the comedy. Like yeah, I was going to the Improv and the Comedy Store, and I saw concerts. I was like an Elvis Costello. Like I was not a punky guy. I was sort of new wavy.
You were comedy music. Yeah. I know. Yeah. We have the same music. It's so, the same thing. It's, yeah.
I didn't want to get spit on. I didn't want to get into sort of like, you know, a fight and get kicked in the head and all that. I wasn't that angry.
Right.
I wasn't that kind of guy.
I kind of was.
Yeah. Intellectually, you know, stimulated. I wanted to have fun. Yeah. I went to old movies and revival houses. I had a different kind of Valley experience.
Sure. Yeah. You're more, They Might Be Giants, Elvis Costello-y.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Bare
Naked Ladies
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Yes.
Right. That all tracks. And then you, and aside from Michael Jackson, like, who else did you grow up around?
Celebrity wise?
Yeah. They'd be like, oh, really?
Okay. Well, I mean,
who was in the house? Cause I didn't know this about you.
Well,
I should have assumed.
Dad was, he used to write for Stephen Eady.
Okay.
Steve Lawrence and Edie Gorman.
Right. So well, they were at your wedding.
They were family, you know, almost family members.
Right.
And then became literally family members when their son David married my cousin Faye.
Okay.
So then they're now literally family members. I had, you know, Rob Reiner and Albert Brooks used to come over and,
as kids.
Or no, adults with my famous. Dad's age, you know, they're more like my dad's age,
right,
my dad's
yeah.
generation of people.
I guess so, yeah.
And so they would come over and hang out with my dad. And trying to think of like that kind of
wow.
Barry Levinson was in his my dad's posse.
I believe co-wrote High Anxiety.
I think so. And yeah. He did. He may have worked on Blazing Saddles too.
Probably,
And then, you know, a lot of. You know, Cabernet was in our lives a lot.
Yeah,
and
she was your dad's boss.
She was my dad's boss, but she was really sweet and really nice.
Oh, that's nice to know.
Incredibly. I mean, she made me think show business was a good place to be.
Oh, that's
a good
funny.
Career. Because people are... I thought when my dad worked on for Carol that it meant that you showed up for your job. You were very professional. You were very kind to everybody. That everybody was very sweet to one another. That that was a very warm and welcoming place.
That is insane.
Right. And then when my dad worked for Bob Newhart, I felt that's the exact same thing.
Yeah, he did have a very, like a beautiful run of like lovely
really
people
nice people who were still friendly with today and who were just like, you know, family friends, and just, you know, Tim Conway and all those people were just the sweetest, warmest, nicest people, funny as hell, comedians and comedy writers over all the time. And I was just like that annoying kid, trying to make them laugh, you know, and occasionally succeeding and most of the time, you know, being escorted out of the room.
Professional comedy people respect kids that try to be funny. Like if they see you, I know with my kids, like if I see my daughter like trying to put a bit together, I'm like, way to go. That's, you're not just like talking in a funny, no, you're trying to put a bit together.
Yeah. I guess my dad would give me like notes.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, like the punchline at the end, son, or later. Like this is here's the time. Don't hit it too hard. All those kind of things. He would give me that, and which is fine. I didn't want the notes. I want to laugh.
You're a kid.
I was a kid. I wanted my dad to say, "Oh, I love you, son." that would have been nice too.
How about a catch?
Exactly. he did say that. Don't get me wrong. He said, "I love you, son," plenty. But
yeah,
that was the impetus of all that. So it was interesting that we got notes. And when I brought my soon to be wife over for a family dinner, when she made a joke, my dad started correcting her jokes. this woman who is in her 30s and she said, what is your father doing? I said, just, it's what he does. It's fine. And my wife, who actually is a professional comedy writer, she wrote on Friends and some other things. So it's like, you know, she was especially.
Yeah, she's not like an amateur.
Yeah, exactly. So she just didn't understand because her family's from Texas. They don't do that.
I remember, this is name droppy, but I remember talking to Albert Brooks at a Simpsons event a long time ago. And it never lost on me that I'm talking. I mean, that would be like if I was a musician, I was talking to Elvis Costello.
Right.
Like, he was my like.
Right.
Albert Brooks and George Carlin were the two people that I was like,
yeah, I've had conversations.
Touch the hem of their.
Yeah. Unbelievable. I've had a conversation with all three of those men, and every single time I've had conversation, the only person that ever felt good about talking to was George Carlin.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. He was truly a full human being.
He sure was.
Yeah.
He recognized me when I spoke to him, and he wasn't putting on anything. He was connecting with me as a person, and boy, did I really appreciate that, because he was my hero. I did not get that experience with Albert for a different reason. And Elvis Costello wasn't mean or cruel. He's just Elvis Costello. He's got a lot of people running up to him, hugging him
all day. It's got to be hard to be all three of those people. And I too have had conversations with all of them, and have walked away unscarred. But that's sometimes the most you can get. Like, okay, it didn't go terrible.
I was scarred by Albert once, but I was Elvis Costello. I think I've met him probably 25 times.
Oh my God. No, I met him twice.
Each time it's the same conversation, which is, hello, my name is Jay Kogan. Yeah. I'm a big fan. We've met before at such and such. We did blah, 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 blah. I'll remind him of occasions and he'll go, oh, yes, right. And then I'll talk about some latest thing that he's done and talk about things and just want to say once again that your music means a great deal to me. Yeah. And, I know you hear this from a lot of people, but it's true. And you should let it sink in. And that's all. And then walk away. Yeah. And it's just been the same. That's what it is.
Yep.
That's fine. And that's fine. But I don't know why I'm expecting him to turn around and go like, Jay, I really recognize you as a fan and your fandom has really meant a lot to me.
It is when you, especially somebody like Elvis or Joe Carlin, like, you know, your voice is in my head all the time.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right.
And yeah, you know who I want to hear how you were scarred by Albert Brooks, but here's somebody that I really admire that I would not want, that I would be afraid to meet. And it's really the only like person that's in my like Mount Rushmore of people that I haven't met. Pete Townsend.
Oh, wow.
Like I definitely would be afraid to meet Pete Townsend.
What would you say to him?
Your music is in my head at some point every day.
Yeah.
You know, and
fuck off.
Just run away.
I mean, it's like what, like
I don't know what, I don't know what it is. And that's like, I said, I got to meet Elvis once backstage and it was atrocious, but he was polite. It was
sure.
Somebody said, do you want to meet Elvis? Sure. And somebody goes, this is Dana Gould. He's a client of the agency. He'd like to meet Elvis. So this woman walks me into this room. Elvis talking to a bunch of people. She interrupts him and says, Elvis, you have a fan who wants to meet you. Dana Gould, an actor here in Hollywood. And he looked at me. And I think God, I will always give him the credit. He could see that I wanted to die. I immediately just went like, oh, I really didn't want to interrupt you. It's really nice to meet you.
Right.
He was like, yeah, no, great. And I,
right.
Double
that was not your fault.
And then I met him when he came to The Simpsons. Right. And it was like, I was in the recording studio and it was just like.
Then that's cool. See, yeah, that's a much more, that's a much better environment to sort of hang
in. He's kind of on, professional turf.
I've been in Elvis's company a couple of different times and my new tack is, to not even say, hey, I'm a big fan. It's just to act like I'm his buddy anyway.
No, I think they prefer that.
Yeah.
How you doing? Just
how you doing? Did you see that other act? Start talking about other things.
Yeah.
And pretend like it's not Elvis Costello standing.
I think that they appreciate that.
I guess.
Yeah. I think that.
There's something so false about it, but it's just simpler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happened with Albert?
Well, Albert, it was a very unusual circumstance. So the first first week that my writing partner, Wally Walidarsky, and I were hired to work on The Tracy Ullman Show.
Uh-huh.
We're in the writer's room.
Is that where you met young, smooth-skinned, almond-eyed ingenue Rob Cohen?
That is where I met Rob Cohen. He was a PA on The Tracy Ullman Show.
Who I was texting with about 40 minutes ago.
A very, very tall Jewish man. Mm-hmm. Jewish-Canadian.
He is Milhouse, apparently.
Is he?
That's what the rumor is.
I don't know. But they look similar.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he is or he isn't, why not?
Elvis Costello and Milhouse also look similar.
Right. Maybe. I know the guy from Guns N' Roses says that Duff Beer is named after him. And I created Duff Beer, and I did not name it after him. So you never know. But if he wants to take claim for
it. Where did you get Duff Beer from?
Just the word ass. That you're sitting on your duff when you're drinking.
Oh God! And then I never thought of
drinking
that.
Beer.
You also named Kang and Kodos. Did you know?
Sure.
The only Simpsons thing I have in my house, outside of my house,
right,
which I paid for,
right,
is Kang and Kodos figures.
Oh, very nice
over there. Yeah.
Not only did we help name, actually, John Vitti was instrumental in remembering the Star Trek names.
Kodos, Kang, and Kodos, Klingon
and Sarak, which was also in that episode. But I drew. Those are the only characters in The Simpsons I ever drew.
Oh, really?
Because the stage directions confused Matt Groening, actually, at the time. It was sort of like he was reading the stage direction. He was trying to figure out what to tell the people who draw the characters, what to do. And the stage direction said, it's an octopus, one-eyed octopus with fangs in a diver's helmet with slime.
That's pretty, I can get that.
And I went and he said, what do you mean? And I went a diver's helmet. It's and so I drew it and it came out, I'd say, what I drew was 35% what it became.
Sure.
But I was very happy that,
that's funny.
That my prototype is the...
No, I have a cell of Kang and Kodos.
Yeah.
They're my favorite. Kangos and Mo are my favorite characters.
Yeah, I'm very, very proud of Kang and Kodos.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Run, he's got a board with a nail in it. That was the thing that really put me away.
I'm very, very proud of those characters. The many characters that we helped create. But,
I created one.
Which is?
Ling Bouvier, the adopted Chinese daughter of Selma Bouvier.
Okay, very good.
I literally created her.
All right. Congratulations.
Yeah, and we were home one day, and I don't know if you go through this with your son. I call him Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Because of his...
His middle name's Sinatra.
Yeah, right, I call him Frank.
He's on Spotify, Charlie Cogan. Go download his album.
Really?
Charlie Cogan.
Okay.
He's got an album called, it's a really great album that's heavily influenced by Elvis Costello and some other Beach Boys and some other people.
I have to listen to this.
And it's called Songs from the Front Seat, which is wow. it's a really smart, sharp album. And just released a brand new song that's not part of the album. I
think it's called Dropping a Song. He dropped a song.
he dropped a song called Unmarked Ticket about a week ago.
Wow.
And it's so look him up, Charlie Kogan on Spotify, Amazon Music, all the places you get music.
Wow.
And go get his song.
That's
his music.
I will.
They're true tales.
In the early 1950s, Robert Harrison, a first-generation American, son of Russian-Jewish immigrants, made a lot of money, publishing what were then called girly magazines. Naughty newsstand nuggets with titles like Beauty Parade and Wink. Cheesecake photos that showed nothing, but were very popular with soldiers and the like in the days before Playboy magazine. But then, Playboy magazine came along and, you know, blew the top off the whole operation, if you know what I mean. But Robert Harrison did not approve of nudity, at least in magazines. And this left magazines like Beauty Parade and Wink unable to compete. And one by one, Robert Harrison's magazine empire disappeared from the newsstands. Enter Estes Kefauver. Yes, that's a real name. Estes Kefauver was a Democratic senator from the great state of Tennessee. That was back then when they would have a Democratic senator. And in 1951, news of organized crime had begun to roil to the top of the news headlines. Now, these were not typical Muggsy and Slugsy hoodlums, but an elaborate network of criminals, a crime syndicate, which went under the catch-all name that had been derived from the Sicilian slang term for boldness or swagger, mafioso, which got anglicized into the Mafia. Yes, that mafia. FBI head honcho J. Edgar Hoover famously looked the other way to a large degree at the mafia's activities for personal and professional reasons that we will go into in a future episode of this very podcast. Hoover instead focused on the growing specter of the international communist conspiracy. But not so Estes Kefauver, who launched a committee investigating the mafia's influence into labor racketeering. Now, this was not easy, since half the state and local officials all over the goddamn country were in bed with the mafia in one way or another. But again, we will mine this vein in a future episode. The Kefauver hearings were televised and caused a national sensation, especially when the late Bugsy Siegel's ex, Virginia Hill, testified. Now, you might be wondering how Bugsy Siegel died, as he was so young and virile. Virginia Hill, wrapped in mink and brimming with piss and vinegar, well, we know vinegar, gave a star turn that captivated the nation. Nearly 30 million people watched the hearings. Bigger than the audience for the World Series that year, the televised investigations were referred to as the Kefauver Hours, and restaurants and department stores emptied out as people sat glued to their TV sets. Along that same time, between 1948 and 1952, a series of books were published under the title Confidential. New York Confidential, Chicago Confidential, Washington Confidential, and USA Confidential, to be precise. These were what James Ellroy, who not coincidentally named one of his greatest novels L.A. Confidential, would later come to describe as hate tracts. Only these weren't crude mimeographed broadsheets written by amateurs. These were big, official, dag-blammit books for sale at your local druggist. To quote Samantha Barbas's book, Confidential Confidential, which was the major source of information for this piece, the confidential books were, quote, lascivious, right-wing, racist, sexist, homophobic, and largely false. In their pages, communists, spies, criminals, gays, intellectuals, New Dealers, African Americans, and women joined together in a sinister conspiracy to subvert the nation. The book sold more than 7 million copies
and introduced a new nastiness, a viciousness, and a sexual smearing into politics and popular culture. End quote. One line from USA Confidential sums it up. Quote, greedy groups of misguided ninnies are turning America into a nightmare. End quote. Thank God we've outgrown all of that crap, huh? Robert Harrison figured that if a series of books called Confidential would fly off the shelves, a magazine with the same approach would do just as well. And just so there would be no confusion, he racked his brain until he came up with a strikingly similar title. Confidential. The first issue hit the stands in December of 1952, and in less than a year, when its cover posed the question, why is Joe DiMaggio striking out with Marilyn Monroe? Its circulation had jumped to 800,000 copies. Confidential magazine was as racist as it was homophobic, and for its time period, the early 1950s, one has to keep in mind that no other magazine was writing about these subjects in this bold and ugly a way. One article entitled, They Pass for White, read, and again, I quote, African Americans were passing as Caucasian, and that this was the biggest, most fantastic, and most pathetic trick ever played on the white race. For more than 20 years, some 5 million Negroes have been living a big white lie. They've turned their backs on their own race and crossed over the line into the world of whites. And very few of the so-called superior race ever realizes it. End quote. So-called superior race. Ouch. It also delighted in outing closeted gay stars. The second issue posed the question, is it true what they say about Johnny Ray? Johnny Ray was a popular crooner and teen heartthrob who had scored a big hit with the song Cry.
If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye,
Johnny had also been arrested in Detroit for soliciting an undercover police officer in the men's room of a burlesque house and was walking a publicity tightrope so he would not have to send his career a letter of goodbye. The Johnny Ray story is also a perfect example of Harrison's approach to Confidential, which was to start with one unassailable fact and then infer a shitstorm around it. Its story read, a suave, sophisticated audience in New York's internationally known Copacabana Club had seen Johnny Ray in drag, a cynical Broadway term for a man who dresses as a woman. Could a skilled psychiatrist revamp his personality to eliminate these outbursts of femininity? Now, none of that had happened. But if he sued, he would have to go on the stand, and then they could ask him about his arrest in Detroit. So Johnny had a choice between letting it go or putting himself on the line to argue it. The leading muckraking gossip columnist of the day was Walter Winchell, a former Roosevelt New Dealer who followed the money by veering far, far, far to the right in the commie paranoid 1950s. Imagine Donald Trump if his only job was to tweet. That would be awesome, by the way. If you have ever seen the classic film Sweet Smell of Success, and if you haven't, I recommend it, Burt Lancaster plays J.J. Hunsecker. J.J. Hunsecker is basically Walter Winchell, an all-powerful New York-based syndicated newspaper columnist who parked at his table at 21 and ruled the city with an iron fist. Merely a mention in his column could make you or break you. Here is the real Walter Winchell in all his glory.
Mr. and Mrs. United States, the topic of very great interest this week was the controversy over cigarettes and cancer of the lung. Against the cigarette is this evidence. Every one of the studies reported that there is an association between excessive smoking and cancer of the lung. I mean excessive smoking, not ordinary smoking. But 25 other scientists say that the case against the cigarette is not proven. These specialists state that the substantial majority of heavy smokers do not contract lung cancer.
'cause everything old is new again.
I said everything old is new again.
Robert Harrison began to use Confidential magazine, unsolicited, to start kissing Walter Winchell's ass. Walter Winchell noticed and, unsolicited, returned the favor and began plugging Confidential in his column. This was exactly what Robert Harrison hoped would happen, and soon Confidential's circulation skyrocketed. This was 1953, when Harrison began turning his attention to Hollywood. Now, the timing could not have been better for Harrison, or worse for the stars in Hollywood who had something to hide. And that was pretty much everybody. In the 1930s and 40s, Hollywood studios were omnipotent. They made the movies, and they owned the theater chains that showed the movies. Actors and actresses were kept under contract, told what movies to make and when to make them, where to go, who to be, and if they got into trouble, studios had fixers to get them out of trouble. People like Eddie Mannix and Howard Strickling. Here is a story of how Hollywood fixers in the 30s and 40s worked. This is taken directly from an excellent article called The Fixers Who Buried Hollywood's Biggest Scandals by Kristen Hunt. Loretta Young became pregnant by her co-star Clark Gable in 1935 while they were shooting The Call of the Wild. At the time, Gable was married to his second of his five wives, Maria Langham. And according to Young's daughter-in-law, the sexual encounter was not consensual. Now again, this was 1935, when an unmarried woman was not supposed to be pregnant, and it would have annihilated Loretta Young's career. Young was Catholic and refused to have an abortion, so Howard Strickling sent her into hiding. He first told the press that she was on vacation. Then she was simply ill. But when she missed her sister's wedding, reporters went into a frenzy of speculation. So Howard Strickling arranged for an interview between his friend, a journalist at Photoplay, and Young, who was nearly 9 months pregnant. Young remained in a bed piled high with strategically placed pillows and blankets for the entire interview. A studio nurse was sent in several times to replace prop intravenous bottles. After Young gave birth to her daughter, the system went into high gear. The baby girl stayed at a bungalow in Venice Beach for several months and was then placed in an orphanage. Over a year later, Young announced that she planned to adopt two orphan children. But in a surprise turn of events, she explained, the biological mother came to claim the totally non-existent second baby. So she simply wound up with Judy, her actual biological child. The MGM fixers helped her plan every step of this elaborate charade, which Young stuck by publicly throughout her lifetime. She only confirmed the truth to her daughter in 1966 and to the world in the year 2000 when her autobiography was posthumously published. End quote. That's how powerful the movie studios were. But then two things happened. In 1948, the United States government brought an antitrust case against Paramount Pictures, and Paramount Pictures lost. The decision forced studios to sell their theater chains. Also, television happened, which ate into studios' profits mightily. Now, with less money in the till, the studios could no longer afford people like Eddie Mannix and Howard Strickland. Unprotected, stars with skeletons in their closet, or who were there in the closet with them, were sitting ducks. It was perfect timing for Confidential magazine, which started making troubling accusations at the very moment movie studios could no longer afford to paper over the answers. A Confidential cover story in 1953 accused RKO studio owner Howard Hughes of having allegedly 164 girlfriends stashed in apartments all over Hollywood. That story was pretty much true. The next issue implied that Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe's relationship was very much on the rocks, and that Marilyn was beholden to a sugar daddy named Joe Schenck, a 76-year-old toad of a man who happened to be one of the co-founders of 20th Century Fox. This also true. Confidential had its own private dirt factory in Los Angeles, Hollywood Research, Inc., run by Harrison's 26-year-old niece. but it employed people like Freddie Otash, a former LAPD officer turned unofficial fixer and leg breaker when needed. Hollywood Research Inc. operated like a professional blackmail factory. Once a story on a celebrity was put together, someone like Freddie Otash would visit the subject of the story and ask if they would like to either buy the story back — this still goes on today and is known as catch and kill — or they could hold the story back in exchange for another juicier story that they might be able to tell them. And once you were on the hook, you were on the hook. Confidential magazine stories kept coming. Does Desi really love Lucy? Is Ava Gardner, currently dating Frank Sinatra, stepping out with Sinatra pal Sammy Davis Jr.? Confidential outed Van Johnson, Tab Hunter, and loudly stated that Liberace's theme song should be Mad About the Boy. Actress Elizabeth Scott was accused of hanging out with Hollywood's, quote, weird society of baritone babes. Bob Hope cheated on Dolores. Errol Flynn had a two-way mirror in his guest bedroom. Ava Gardner and Lana Turner had a three-way with a Palm Springs bartender. Kim Novak slept her way to the top. Mike Todd cheated on Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor cheated on Mike Todd. But pride goeth before the fall, and the bigger Confidential got, the more vicious it got, the more nasty it got, the more crude it got, and finally, Hollywood started to rebel. To begin with, Robert Harrison started getting death threats. Lots of them! Then superstar Hollywood lawyer Jerry Geisler and several studio heads contacted California Attorney General Pat Brown to investigate the potential criminality in Confidential's business practices. Now, Pat Brown was no dummy. He had political aspirations. He would go on to become California's governor and would give birth to California Governor Jerry Brown. Pat Brown saw his pursuit of Confidential as a win-win, and he initiated the Kraft Committee, which looked into illegal activities by private detectives. In other words, Hollywood Research Inc. In other words, Confidential Magazine. The Kraft Committee failed to turn up anything concrete, but it did succeed in chumming the water with Confidential's blood. Less than a week later, Confidential was indicted on federal criminal charges. This was based on an article entitled, "The Pill That Ends Unwanted Pregnancy." The magazine said it was an article that warned against using such a pill. The government said it was giving information on how abortions could be procured. Dorothy Dandridge sued for $2 million, but unlike previous lawsuits, she included in her suit the owners of every newsstand that sold Confidential. If you wanted to do business with Confidential, you are now opening yourself up to a lawsuit. Liberace sued for $20 million. Mae West, Robert Mitchum, Maureen O'Hara, they all filed lawsuits. Now, the problem with the lawsuits, as I said before, was that the stars were terrified to show up in court. If Tab Hunter was called on the stand to testify that Freddie Otash tried to blackmail him with a story about his attendance at an all-male pajama party, he could be asked, on cross-examination, "Did you not attend an all-male pajama party?"
Well?
Confidential magazine was killed not by a knockout blow, but by death of a thousand cuts. It settled many of its lawsuits out of court, but that bled it dry financially. It tried to remain in print, but changed its editorial practices so that it was now publishing harmless stories like, "Penicillin can save your life." Like most things in life, Confidential was, at the end of the day, the author of its own destruction. Karma being consistent, if slower on the draw than one would wish. But it didn't go away. It just resurfaced later in a different form, with a different scumbag at the helm. People like the aptly named David Pecker, at the National Enquirer. Why, you might ask?
'Cause everything old is new again.
And now, on with the show.
Watching The Simpsons absentmindedly, Ling Bouvier comes on. I say to Lulu, "Honey, that's you." She goes, "Mm-hmm." I go, "No, that's you. That's the character Daddy created based on you." She just goes, "Yeah, I like Bob's Burgers." like, yeah. But then, of course.
Right.
She's not going to be impressed by my job.
That's not, that's not job. Thanks, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, have to tell me what happened.
Okay, so anyway, Wally Wolodarski, my old high school buddy, and I work and write spec scripts and do what you have to do. And right. finally, we get hired to write a script for the Tracy Ullman show. Then they hire us as a low-level story editor, staff writer position on the Tracy Ullman show. We're in a writer's room with James L. Brooks and Jerry Belson and Jesus. Heidi Perlman and Sam Simon and Ken Esten, these Cheers people and these Taxi yeah. people and the greatest writers in the world, and Mark Flanagan is a good writer, and all these other people. And also sitting there next to Jim Brooks is Albert Brooks. And Wally and I...
Murderer's Row.
Wally and I are just couldn't believe it, and just like we weren't excited to work our first day. We were not expecting Albert Brooks.
Yeah, that's awful.
To be sitting there and working with us. And we just look at each other like, Albert Brooks is sitting there. What do we do? And yeah. we're just like, we do nothing. We just be quiet.
So
we
smart.
Just, we just listen. We'll pitch jokes when we have a joke. But just this is our first week. Let's just be cool. Let's just be cool. Let's just sit back and see what the lay of the land is. Mm-hmm. Let's just be cool. So we.
That's a very mature attitude for kids that you're certainly in your
22
20s. Yeah, you're very. I did not have that cool back then.
You never had that cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But your MO is not to sit back
yeah.
and just be quiet. Well,
no, but when I started at The Simpsons, I had been through enough that I yeah. knew that it wasn't the Dana Gould show.
Right, right. Yeah. But you're, you know, I think part of your, you know, how you operate is, you know, you talk.
I am the sun on the box of Raisin Bran of life.
So that's, you know, and not everything's going to be gold, but there's going to be gold eventually.
Yeah, it's much more of a Gatling gun approach.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
I will kill him too, you know, but it's going to take a lot of bullets.
It's not unlike Conan O'Brien, who does the similar yeah. pattern of stuff. He's like, yeah. he's going to talk, and some of it's going to be really funny.
Yeah.
Some of it, you just got to get through a lot of it.
Yeah.
But you know, nobody like you, like yeah. Conan, nobody's going to come up with some of the stuff that you guys come up with. It's just amazing. So it's
sure.
It's
but we are not the comedy version of American Sniper. I only need 3 bullets.
Right. Exactly. You get through it. Anyway, so we're quiet. We're quiet. And by the way, we're quiet for like 2-3 days. Like we pitch every now and then we pitch a joke. We're cool.
Yeah.
The most exciting thing was to get to order food. Right. We'd been getting food for other people.
And did Albert come in the whole week?
He's been there the whole time.
Holy shit.
No explanation of why he's there. He's just there. Literally, no discussion. Everybody's acting like he should be there.
Fine. And he's pitching and.
Yeah. He's pitching on jokes. No explanation of why he's there. Then we go to watch run throughs and rehearsals and he's there and we go back and it's Albert Brooks is there every day. And then on the fourth day, we're walking from the writer's room to a run through. And as we're walking, Albert's alone and I sidle up to Albert and I say, listen, we've been working together for about 3-4 days. And I just have to say, it's a great honor for me to be in a room with you. I've seen all your movies. I think they're genius. I think you're genius. And I just love watching yeah. you work. And it's just a pleasure for, you know, I have Comedy Minus One. I've memorized yeah. the whole, I just know it all. And I just wanted to just say thank you for all that stuff. And he turns to me and say, he starts looking at me and then he starts yelling at me. You want me to do 5 minutes for you?
Oh.
Want me to do a bit? Is that what you want? He starts screaming at me like I want him to perform for me.
Oh.
Like I wanted, they start screaming. Like he suddenly heard from me. I identified him as who he didn't want to be identified as a star or
right.
that other thing. He's there for some other reason and I blew his cover
oh.
and he was not happy.
Oh.
And so he was screaming at me and I thought it's a bit.
Yeah.
Like he's screaming at me like it's a bit, but I couldn't for the life of me figure out the bit of that. Yeah, and I still can't, and it's been 30 years, so
yeah.
I'm still waiting for it. And I subsequently I've seen him since.
Did he stalk off?
Yeah.
You must have wanted to die.
I was not happy. I was confused. I didn't think I did anything wrong. But I was confused.
No, you didn't. Clearly,
but, I was confused, and I said,
"You always run that risk when you do that to someone." Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't do it again. But it seemed, he was nicer to me later on in other places. And again, I mentioned to you.
Do you think he put it together that you were that guy, or does he?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, I told you he'd been at my house. Had my friends with my dad. Like, I didn't really know him.
Yeah,
but he'd been. Yeah. There's a tangential.
Had you said to him? When you saw him, you may not remember me. I'm Arnie Kogan's son. I've met you, you've been in my house a couple of times.
I may have said,
"You want me to come over and have a sandwich?"
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember how much I said and how much I didn't say. I was trying to lay low. So I was just trying to just take this opportunity to 5-minute walk from one place to another to just say it's cool that you're here. And then so that was my Albert Brooks story. And I don't know what was going on with Albert and what was happening. And I've subsequently, obviously, I forgive it. It's,
but yeah, you've had cool interactions with him.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's pleasant and
well, he is a genius.
Yeah.
And like all geniuses.
Yeah.
Somewhat tortured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay.
That's understandable.
All right. But I will never forget it.
Oh, no, no,
and
no.
And it was one of those shocking moments in my life.
No, Mel yelled at me once, but he was mad at his son, not Max. And he was like, "Do you get along with your children?" Because he just had like some kind of tangent. Right. And, you know, I was... in my 50s, so I was pretty. I was like, "Yeah, what's going on?" And just I took it
right.
And but I was also thinking like, I would not want him to yell at me, like yelling at me,
right?
And then you go home and you look at your DVD collection,
right?
Whatever, like, oh, the guy who made that movie thinks I'm an asshole.
It's like boy, I've got such a thick skin for that now.
You have to.
That the some of my heroes that I work with that turned out to be people who yell and people who like to sort of, that's their MO, is to sort of scream at you or scream at people around them.
It's very hard to have a civil discussion with anyone on Twitter. There's just something innate about the format that it's just an id projector.
Yeah.
And Kobe Bryant passed away and immediately... 90% of the people on Twitter, which is a sliver of the country, were like, "Oh, what a terrible thing." And then 10% was, "He was a rapist." And I said, maybe give him a day.
Right.
As you put it quite brilliantly, it's not the sum total of what he is.
Many things.
Many things. And a guy answered me, "Well, don't you think?" And I was like, and then I was venting about Twitter. And then he was like, I really like you. I really respect you. I'm not trying to think. You're really digging in. And then I could see that he was you and I was being Albert.
Right.
And I was like, no. But I went out of my way. Like, no, I'm not mad at you.
Right.
I really love that you like my stuff.
Right.
I'm venting about Twitter. This has nothing to do with you.
And
I would feel horrible.
Of course.
You know.
But it's one of those things where I don't know that in that moment, like Albert – was
who knows what's
knowing
going on
what
him.
Was going on in his head or whatever. Maybe he was feeling attacked. Maybe he was feeling unseen the way he wanted to be seen. There's a lot of different things that's going on. Just like on Twitter, that kid thought you were mad, or that person thought you were mad at him or her.
Yeah,
and you could perceive the problem with Twitter and all those things. The tone, you don't know the tone that people are approaching you with. So you have no idea. In your head, it could be an insult. It could be a shout. It could be a compliment. It could be just a thought. You don't know. It's in your own projection.
Well, I could tweet, "I love The Simpsons," and I would get a raft of shit. It would just be, there are people who are starving and you're watching cartoons. Like, it's just a dog shit.
Everybody wants me online to say how shitty The Simpsons is now. They want me to say The Simpsons is shitty now. And I don't think The Simpsons is shitty now. I think The Simpsons is really good now.
Yeah.
I think The Simpsons has been good for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's just a really, really great restaurant and people have gotten used to the food.
Yes. And also, you know, when The Simpsons was great, the best years of The Simpsons were when you started watching it.
Exactly. When you were a kid and it was new to you, that's when it was great.
Years.
Just like people, their favorite Star Wars is when they were 10.
Yeah. I can tell you how old you are by your favorite James Bond.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like when it hits you. So but people get infuriated because they want to extol the years that Wally and I were on, like the first five, then it went downhill because you left. They said, no, the people that were making it great were still making it great for years on after that. And it was still great for years on after that.
Yeah.
You changed. You grew out of it, or you got used to it, or you, something about it became less fresh for you. But when I watch the episodes, I laugh every time.
Yeah. It's like Kiss.
Yeah.
The band, not the act.
Right.
Yeah, when you first discovered Kiss, there's nothing like Kiss.
Right.
And now you think of Kiss, it looks like they're still doing the same thing they were doing when you loved them at 13.
It's a clown show now.
It's a clown, It's just that you're 50. You're no longer 14.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's different now.
And how long were you and you and Wally were partners at the foundation of The Simpsons? You surfed that tidal wave of
That was so much fun.
It must have been weird to be like in season, three, four, five, when you guys are the Beatles of writing staffs.
Well,
you're still a writing staff.
They didn't extol the writing staff. They extolled the show.
But to be a part of something we're on fire.
The cultural impact of the show was very big.
Yes.
And so it was one of those things where you couldn't go anywhere without seeing that thing.
Sure.
So
being Bart Simpson was on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Yeah, and a million magazines and TV Guide. And by the way, kids, TV Guide was a magazine that people used to get to see what was on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were programs that you could only see at certain times.
That's right. I know this is sounds bizarre.
Right. But I mean, it was unbelievable how everywhere you could see Simpson stuff, and there was counterfeit Simpson stuff, and there's Simpson stuff on the freeway, and there was Simpson people selling T-shirts and all that kind of stuff. And that cultural phenomenon stuff was a buzz, was really fun and exciting, and all that stuff was great. But it wasn't, it was still hard work to make the show, and we really were proud of the show, and we're shocked that people liked it that much. And I don't know if you ever heard the testing of the show about
the only thing I understand from the testing was that people liked yellow.
People liked the pretty colors and when people hit their heads. That's what we heard. Like we spent, we worked until 3 a.m. trying to get that great joke and cram it with really smart references. And then we get, this report back that says people like the pretty colors and when people hit their heads.
Three nights ago, I'm getting ready to go out with a pitch, throw my Willie Loman way out there with a pair of suitcase full of pants.
Right.
Just up late working, trying to get it's been done. I don't want to do that. And, come out in the next morning. My kids are just watching the television set, just enraptured. They have the computer playing on the TV set, and they're watching videos of people filling up surgical gloves with water.
Right. Yeah.
And then, they tie them to a string and they intertwine them with Christmas lights.
Right.
It's like a craft show.
Uh-huh.
And they're just, I'm like, why?
Yeah.
Why was I up till 2?
No, there's no reason. There is no reason that you were up till 2. Because that's entertainment.
Yeah.
New entertainment.
My 10-year-old is obsessed with like any British cooking show, like British people making cupcakes in a tent.
Those are pretty
She goes
fun.
Bananas and the royal family. And I don't expect were at the grocery store and she's 10.
Yeah.
And she grabbed the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
And I go, honey, you don't want to read that. It's garbage. And she goes, Daddy, it's the Royals. And we went out to, it was Bobby Burns night the other night, Scottish poet.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to a pub on Sunset to celebrate it called the Pikey.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought Nelly and we met a friend of my girlfriend's who's English. And Nelly asked her what she thought of Meghan, whatever her name is.
Meghan Markle?
Meghan Markle.
Yeah.
Like she was, said, what do you think? Do you think it's good what they're doing?
Right.
It's like, who is this person?
Well, I mean,
Megxit. It's Megxit.
And is she very upset about it?
She is very upset. I would imagine. And she said, and apparently Prince Charles is sick because his feet are swelling and his hands are swelling.
Sure.
They think he's got a heart issue. And,
it's very upsetting.
He's very upset.
It's very
about
upsetting
it.
About the royals, yeah. And
it's amazing.
I can understand if you're interested in the royals that this is a big time for you.
It's a big time.
It's a big
for
time,
you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you're talking about that, and it's been sort of a running theme for me this year. I'm assuming you saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Of course, yeah.
This house is in it.
Oh, wow.
Yep. The scene where the second time Brad Pitt is driving Leonardo DiCaprio home from the studio and they see the Manson girls and the Manson girls point like, are you going our way? And mm-hmm. he goes, no, I'm going this way. And
yep.
they turn, the girls walk right up that street right past this house.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know it. I was on the road when they filmed it, apparently. Like, it's my fucking house. but I was like, it would be so interesting. I was talking about this with Allison Martino. I always thought, like, I would love to have been in L.A. in the late 60s, like 66 to 72. To me, it was just like,
why? I was here for 68. Like, I remember it a little bit.
Well, just, you know, at one day in 1968, the Doors were playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go. Star Trek was shooting on the Paramount lot.
Yeah.
Planet of the Apes was shooting at the Fox Ranch in Malibu. All on the same day.
It was right.
Like all of this amazing stuff was going on. And the culture was different. And I'm just fascinated by that era.
You know what was happening with me? I was in Los Angeles that day that you're talking about. I was watching Speed Racer
sure.
at home eating Cheetos.
Yeah, me. Yeah, I was in Massachusetts. I was in Massachusetts doing the same thing.
So that it doesn't. I wouldn't
have been that age. I would have like time machine.
The
go
context
back.
Of like how much of that culture could you soak up at the time? You know, like my parents were 20 in their 20s. In that era.
No, they didn't do it. Yeah.
But, you know, and they know, but, you know, they were not partiers and they didn't, but they had access to some of that world and it was not, it's, I think it's idealized. No, I mean, you can't.
Oh, it is. But it's just, I'm fascinated by that era, the clothes, the music, the way television still had like, you know, a show, like variety shows, a curtain would open and the show would start. Like, I'm fascinated.
No,
look at my house. I mean, my house is a, you know.
I mean, I experienced certainly the variety show part. Yeah. I experienced that life. I experienced, I went to shows. My
glittery curtains.
Yeah. And, I mean, but it's like, it's still here. All that life is still here.
Oh, yeah. No,
you're living it.
I'm aware of it.
That Largo is the whiskey. Like, it's not that different. Like, there's a world of performers and things going on.
Well, that's the point. But in terms of the business and the culture in 1969 was tearing itself apart.
Yeah.
The culture was being pulled to the seams, and show business, as described in Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, like the movie industry certainly didn't know what it was doing.
Right. So it's happening again.
And that's what I mean. We are in that time again. The culture is straining at the bit.
Yeah.
And we are in a business that is in a volcanic reinvention.
Absolutely.
And we do not know where it's. And I look at, here's a, you know.
Well, I know what I'm doing is surgical gloves. I'm doing only surgical gloves. Everything I do.
Here's the thing about surgical gloves I learned.
Yep.
It's pretty good. For like a Halloween party. Uh-huh. You fill them up with water, you tie the end, you freeze them, and then you put them in a punch bowl, and they're like ice.
Okay, good. Done.
But it looks like hands.
13 on the air.
13 on the air.
Yeah, okay.
There's 13. There's no more 13
on
the
air. That's true. There is no air.
8 on your phone. But yeah, you know, the business doesn't know what it's doing.
Yeah.
And I find that, you know, scary economically. And kind of funny. Like, we go to these meetings and you can't say this out loud because they kick you out, but you want to go like, I know that you don't know what you're doing. And it is fascinating. But then you have other things like here in Los Angeles has become a city that I love. Like, I grew up when you were watching Speed Racer, we're about the same age.
Mm-hmm.
You were watching Speed Racer. I was watching Speed Racer at the same time in Massachusetts in a little little town, a beautiful little town, actually. But now I'm out in Los Angeles, where I've always wanted to live, working in the business that I've always wanted to live in. But I have seen in the past 5 years, LA turn into a tent city.
Yeah.
And, you know, rents are inexplicably skyrocketing. People with jobs cannot afford apartments.
Right.
And they, you know, and they go, well, everybody in the street's crazy. Yes, because living in the street will drive you crazy. You know, if you lived on the street for a week,
yeah,
you would start to lose your bearings.
Right.
And in Studio City, stores are closing because people shop online. No one goes to the store. The rents are, you know, their business income is down. Their rents are going up. They shutter the store. Then you have a block of stores that are empty. Property values go down. And, you know, it seems like this is the cultural equivalent of a big forest fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's clearing out all of the dead wood. And I don't know when it's going to end and what's going to replace it.
Well, I do, but I'm not allowed to tell you.
Oh, shit.
But yeah, I'm sorry, Dana.
Are the stonecutters.
Yeah, I apologize. I will say this. Get out. So
I do.
I'm going to just tell you that.
You don't think I'm not looking?
Yeah, no, get out.
Yeah.
You maybe come back in 7 years.
Yeah,
seven years. 7 years. Yeah. That's good. It'll
Have
be
you
fine.
Seen Conquest of the Planet of the Apes? The fourth one.
Yeah. You're right. It's a crazy time. I mean, who knows what's coming? So, I find it a little exciting too, but it's a little unnerving, but show business is interesting. We're cut out for it because we've lived a life of show business where everything's on the edge all the time.
All the time.
Anyway,
yep.
You're always, your next job is always a question mark, but this is now, I think it's maybe true for a lot of people in a lot of economies where people don't know what's happening and know what's happening all over the place. But I mean, also show business itself is even less stable than it was. That's true too.
No, I say to people, how you doing? I'm just like you. I'm working five times as hard for one third the money.
Right.
Which so it's kind of true.
Yeah. So it's a big hustle. And it continues to be a big hustle, but what am I going to do? I have no alternative.
Nope. The only way out is through.
Yeah. Yeah. So we do. We will work stuff and we'll pitch stuff and we'll do whatever it is.
Yeah. And yeah. I do worry. I worry about the, you know, the culture writ large. I know that it will, you know, it's the nature of system. Entropy is the innate nature of systems. They rise, they putrefy, they collapse, they reinvent themselves. And I think that this is the digital revolution has really changed how we view entertainment and shop and communicate.
Yes. Huge changes. The change of, and what's fascinating,
it's finally caught up to the remnants of how we shopped, communicated and viewed entertainment.
Right.
You know, it's like now stores are closing.
Right.
You know, the television networks are all basically there to launch their online platforms.
Right. Right. They know that their days are numbered.
Yeah.
Even though they're making more money than they've ever made before. But yes. that's who knows how long that'll last.
Right. No, and NBC will make money.
Yeah.
But it's going to be NBC, whatever their platform is, CBS All Access. You know, the most exciting show on CBS is not on CBS. It's on CBS All Access.
Have you seen Picard?
No, but that's what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
No, I want to see it.
I got CBS All Access for Star Trek Discovery. Mm-hmm. I really tried.
Okay.
If I was right. I'm out.
So did you watch Picard?
No, I have to get CBS All Access.
Oh,
again.
I thought you got it.
I got it, and then I got rid of it because I only, you know, I don't want, there's nothing else in CBS All Access I want to watch. And I do try to keep an eye, you know, because it, you know, it's like everything, you 40 things that are $11 a month.
Right.
You know,
it adds up.
It adds up.
I was going to say that the one thing the digital revolution has brought us is, The information age has brought us the lack of information, and that is shocking and fabulous at the same time. Like we live in a world where no one knows what's truth, No one knows what true is anymore.
Objectivity is gone.
Right. And so because there's a million truths now, there's a million truths out there.
It's scary.
And so what we thought could be this beautiful synthesis of all knowledge and we could find what is true is not the way it's used. The way it's used is everything's parsed out and your truth is your truth and my truth is my truth. And there's, and so we're all fucked in terms of, finding common ground and finding common belief and believing in things as basic as science, as basic as facts. Those things don't exist.
In that way, like, we have the perfect president for this time.
Yeah.
In the way that Nixon really was the perfect president for 1969. And that he was a front for the old, he was a front for the old way of doing things, but behind the scenes, everything was chewing itself up and corrupt. And it's like, you know, the sky's blue.
Yeah.
Is it? Right. Sky's green. It's, you know, one of the reasons that I don't talk to anyone in my family of origin about politics is that we live on totally separate planets.
Yeah. But you have to just acknowledge that's true.
I do. No, we get along great because it's just like we're not even arguing the same set of facts.
Right. We're not going to agree that, you know that so-and-so did that. And I've said, no, I don't think that so-and-so did that. I think so-and-so did this. And they said, that's crazy. That's, you've been bought off by that, Jewish billionaire.
They genuinely believe that Nancy Pelosi is the biggest threat to our way of life. We can't have a conversation.
Right.
It's like, and it's the fact that, I was in the airport and they had, the documentary on the CNN's The 60s was playing in the airport and it was Walter Cronkite's coverage of the JFK assassination and everybody was watching it.
Right.
And at that time, you don't have that anymore. You don't have one objective source of information that everybody gets the same information.
Right.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldbaum.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a person, I'm a person, I'm a singer, I love to sing, and DJ, boom, pizza, pizza, you want me, pizza, boom.